Now, the Mexican filmmaker Guillermo del Toro's best known as the master of magical fantasy, with movies like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy under his belt. And since childhood, he's been obsessed with vampires. Now, he's decided to try his hand at fiction writing with a new vampire novel called The Strain. He co-wrote it with Chuck Hogan, a veteran thriller writer. Guillermo del Toro joins us from Burbank, California. Welcome.
Hey, how are you? Pleasure to be here.
I want to describe the opening of this book, The Strain. Basically, a jumbo jet lands at JFK Airport, and almost everyone on board is dead. And it's really where this story of a mysterious and alarming outbreak begins. It almost sounds in that first scene like it's a deliberate reference to Bram Stoker's Dracula, which opens with a mysterious, crewless ship that washes ashore.
Yeah, that is correct. In the novel of Dracula, at one point, the ship Demeter stops at Whitby, and it docks with almost everybody dead and the coffin inside of the cargo area. And it was a deliberate quote on that, in the same way that is a deliberate quote to call one of the main characters Abraham Cetrakian, in honor of Abraham Van Helsing.
Mm.
But the idea was also to create almost like a thriller, a medical thriller, combining medieval fears with cutting-edge science and pandemics and all these horrors that we consider sophisticated but are, in my mind, still medieval horrors that are boogeymen that scare us.
The premise of this book is essentially that vampires have always been with us, but sort of now they're seizing the moment. They're about to take advantage of this opportunity, and they're going to start in Manhattan. Why did you set it in New York?
You know, it is the city that belongs. It's almost like the metropolis of all tales. You know, it takes the imagination of the entire world. And I also wanted to set it up against a background that is powerful, because the vampires in the novels, it's three of them that we're writing, they nest in places of great tragedy. I don't want to spoil any more for anyone that hasn't read it, but,
right.
You know, they are followed, they are tracked through history in places of enormous pain. And there is a very significant portion that takes place in the hollowed out areas beneath World Trade Center.
Now, vampire stories seem to have this kind of universal and endless appeal. And so many writers and movie makers have been able to come up with different scenarios for them. I mean, most recently, you know, sort of seeing vampires hanging out at shopping malls or going to the opera in tuxedos. But your vampires are real villains. I mean, they are really evil.
Well, they are actually just a parasitic, really brutal form of another living creature. And the killings and the drainings, so to speak, are not this warm feeling, like a almost orgasmic Barbara Cartland gothic romance beautiful moment. It is, you know, you turn into a Capri Sun container and these things are sucking you dry, and they are absolutely this feeling of being vacuumed out of your life force is described as in brutal detail as we can.
Did you do that because, in a sense, you feel as if vampires have been portrayed as these kinds of kitschy and almost friendly caricatures of what they ought to be?
Well, I've been a very strange kid, and from the age 7 on, I've been 37 years, I've been deliberately putting together as minute a notebook about vampire biology and about vampire anatomy, and always thinking that the vampires that I was fascinated as a reader by were these monsters. They were not this romantic, decadent, existential bad boys.
We're speaking with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro about his new novel, The Strain. Mr. del Toro, a few weeks ago we interviewed another Mexican filmmaker, Carlos Cuarón, who of course you know very well.
Yes.
I want to put a question to you that I put to Carlos Cuarón, which is about the quality of your filmmaking and now your fiction writing. Is there something distinctively Mexican about what you do and what you produce, even though most of your work no longer takes place in Mexico?
Yes, absolutely. I think the opposite is what is hard to imagine. I come from where I come from, and my culture allows me to sort of believe and accept the supernatural in a readily way. I accept the monsters and the creatures and the fact that they exist in a completely more natural way than I would say an Anglo-Saxon narrator or storyteller would.
one of the big differences between a novel and a movie, of course, is that in a novel, the reader sort of has to take a leap of imagination and picture in his or her mind's eye what's going on. And yet, it seems you can't quite stay away from the movie side here. There are actually some mini films circulating on the internet to promote the book, and they've gone viral on YouTube. Let's hear a bit of one of them.
What you fought was a dead man possessed by a disease.
What, like a zombie?
Well, I think more along the lines of a man with a black cape, fangs, a funny accent. I'll take away the cape, the fangs, and a funny accent. In fact, take away anything funny about it.
I think people who are fans of your work, like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, are going to be asking the question, when are you going to make this into a Del Toro film?
I don't think I will. I really think we intended it as a long-form narrative, and maybe down the line we can try and adapt it into a graphic novel or cable series or something like that, but I would not try to compress them to a single film or something like that.
Now, I've seen photos of the inside of your home in Los Angeles, and I was wondering if you could describe what a visitor to your home in L.A. might encounter.
Well, about a year and a half, I bought myself a second house separate from the family house that I called Bleak House. And in Bleak House, I lodge all my libraries because I've been collecting books since I was 4 years old. I don't have my first book, but I have my second book on, and it's six libraries. One dedicated to horror, one dedicated to art and sculpture, painting, and so forth. Another one dedicated only to fairy tales and folklore, film, comic books, blah, blah, blah. And all of this is side by side with movie props from my movies, other people's movies, statuary, fantastic statuary, about 350 pages of original art from comic books, children's fantasy illustration. It's essentially the man cave that a kid would have if he was financially okay.
And how much time do you spend there?
A lot. I wake up, I take the girls to school, and then I go and work in Bleak House all day, just reading, drawing, writing. I have a secret bookshelf passage that you open, and it leads you into a haunted mansion room. And it's a fantasy place.
Will you give us a tour next time we're in L.A.?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to.
We're looking forward to that. That's film director and novelist Guillermo del Toro. His first novel, co-written with Chuck Hogan, is called The Strain. Mr. Del Toro, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Hey, we have some recommended reading this morning in case you're going on vacation or going nowhere. If you're having a staycation, you really need a book. So librarian Nancy Pearl, a frequent contributor to this program, is eager to share some books that she calls great summer reads. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Steve.
She's at member station KUOW in Seattle today. And I want to begin with a book that's on the stack that you've sent me here called The Disreputable History of Frankie Landau Banks, simply because I love disreputable histories. What is this?
Oh, well, you will love this book because Frankie Landau Banks is one of the best teen characters that I have read in a long, long time. The best thing about this book is Frankie herself. And in the year between her freshman year at this elite prep school where she goes and her sophomore year, she kind of is transformed from this geeky, nerdy kind of girl into this very attractive young woman who thinks she shed all her nerdiness. Mm. And especially because she catches the eye of the most popular boy on campus who happens to be the president of a secret organization. And the secret organization, he won't tell Frankie anything about it. She can't join it because she's a girl. And that really gets her annoyed. And so she decides that she's going to get back at the members of this organization and, in a sense, bring them to their knees. And it's just, it's funny. Frankie is smart. It's just a really smart book on all levels. It would be great for a mother-teen-daughter discussion, too.
So Nancy Pearl is giving us some summer reading here, some vacation reading here, if we have an opportunity to take a vacation. There's another book here, The Color of Lightning, a novel by Paulette Giles.
This is Paulette Giles' third historical novel, and I think she just gets better and better and better with each book. This is a book that's set in the very last years of the Civil War and then through the beginning of the 1870s. And the main character is a freed slave who travels with his family and his former owner to Homestead in North Texas. The man's name is Britt Johnson. And when he and the other men are off to buy supplies for the camp, the Indians raid the camp and they kidnap Britt Johnson's wife and two of his children. And Britt decides when he gets back and finds out what happens that he is going to go rescue them. Does that plot sound familiar?
Where?
Well, this was the basis of, this was from a book by Alan LeMay called The Searchers. And of course, it was made into the John Wayne movie.
Of course. One of the great westerns of all time.
Absolutely. But because of the vagaries of movie making, of course, Britt Johnson was transposed into John Wayne. But Paulette Giles, she's just brought the whole period alive. Can I just read a paragraph?
Please.
One of the things that she talks about in this book is the plight of the young white children who are kidnapped and then are raised by Indians and know nothing, remember very little about their previous existence with their white families. And one of the things that Britt Johnson and men like him did was take these children back home to their white families. And this is a description of one little girl's feelings about that event. And it says, "She was not afraid of going hungry or starvation. She was afraid of the slow death of confinement, of being trapped inside immovable houses and stiff clothing, of the sky shuttered away from her sight, herself hidden from the operatic excitement of the constant wind and the high spirits that came when they struck out like cheerful vagabonds across the wide earth with all of life in front of them and unfolding and perpetually new. And now herself shut in a wooden cave. She could not go out at dawn alone and sing. She would not be seen and known by the rising sun."
Oh, that's beautiful.
Isn't that great?
And you just have a person who was taken away from what white people of that era would have considered civilization, and she's not sure that she likes it anymore.
Absolutely. And I think that that's the thing that Paulette Giles does so well in this book is describe for the reader that great gulf between ways of living.
Well, let's talk about somebody else who must have gone a distance, just because the book here is called A Far Cry from Kensington, Muriel Spark.
This is an older title, and I always love it when I reread a book, and it's still as buoyant and wonderful as when I first read it. A Far Cry from Kensington has one of fiction's great women characters, and that is a woman named Mrs. Hawkins. She's tart, she's loyal to her friends, she is unforgiving toward her enemies, she's easy to confide in, and she's impossibly self-assured. And yet, for all that, for the reader, she's incredibly easy to love. It's a book set in the 1950s in London. Mrs. Hawkins lives in a rooming house, and she works in the publishing industry. And she takes an instant and unending dislike to a hack writer named Hector Bartlett, and she calls him a vomiter of words. And because of that dislike, she incurs his lasting wrath and loses two jobs in the publishing world. And also, to get back at her, Hector either does or does not, we're not really ever sure in this book, but Hector either causes something terrible to happen to one of Mrs. Hawkins' fellow roomers at the house, or he does not. Mm. And Mrs. Hawkins is just an unforgettable character.
Another book on your list, Nancy Pearl, is called The Gone Away World.
Yes, this is Nick Harkaway's first novel. And with most books that you and I talk about, Steve, I feel like I can tell a little bit of the plot. I can say whether it's character-driven, and then people will get an idea of what the book is. But with Nick Harkaway's book, The Gone Away World, I can't tell you anything about it because I don't want to take away from anybody's experience of reading it. And almost anything I say will be too much. But I have to say that it is an incredible experience to read. It's set after an apocalypse. The main character is somebody who all Oh, no, never mind. I can't do that. I messed it up too much.
That's okay.
That's fine. So I can just say that two-thirds of the way through the book, there is a plot twist that will knock your socks off, and you will want to go back and start all over again and see all the hints that that Nick Harkaway gave you that you didn't pick up on.
I guess you can remind us that he comes from a writing family, Nick Harkaway.
He does. He is John le Carré's son. And you can see, I think, some of the great narrative storytelling ability that his father has certainly passed on to Nick.
Some book selections for your summer from Nancy Pearl. Nancy, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
She's author of Book Lust, More Book Lust, and Book Crush. And you can nominate your favorite summer reads at NPR.org.
When you cook, do you use a skillet or a fry pan? At the deli, do you order a hoagie, a hero, a bomber, or a grinder? You can find a passel of these localisms in the Dictionary of American Regional English. The final volume will be published soon, and if you're willing to pungle about $90 for it, it could help you better understand your fellow Americans. Celeste Headley checks it out.
President Clinton was giving a press conference in 1993 when someone mentioned that a certain Air Force official had criticized him. And according to Joan Hall, Clinton answered,
"Well, how could he say that about me? He doesn't know me from Adam's off ox."
Hall is the chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, or DARE.
I got a telephone call from someone at NPR because apparently most of the journalists in that press conference had no idea what he was talking about.
As it turns out, the phrase means he doesn't know him at all, or doesn't know him from Adam. It was also used in the film It's a Wonderful Life. And it's phrases like this that fill the dictionary. The first volume was released in 1975, and after 5 decades of research, S to Z will be published next year. Joan Hall says she gets letters all the time from people who use the dictionary, like a librarian in Tennessee.
Who said that a patron came to her and wanted to know about dry land fish. Well, she looked in every fish book she could think of, to no avail. Finally, she looked in DARE and discovered that dry land fish is a very regional term found almost solely in Kentucky and Tennessee for a mushroom.
The dictionary project was begun in the 1950s by a well-known linguist named Frederick Cassidy. He sent field workers out across the country in word wagons. Over 6 years, they talked to nearly 3,000 people and made recordings to capture pronunciations. Cassidy died in 2000, and his tombstone reads, "On to Z." The DARE is unique because it tells us how we speak, not how to speak.
It's very helpful because it's really more descriptive than prescriptive.
Stephanie Grayson is the founder of CorporateSpeechTrainer.com. She says in some ways, American language is becoming more uniform. Television and the internet are giving us all a common vocabulary.
We're living in a world of now, 140 characters or less on Twitter.
But linguist John Rickford of Stanford University says people speak one way in emails and another way at the local coffee shop.
The primary kind of driving force behind language use and language change is face-to-face interaction. And that takes place in smaller communities and smaller groups, the kinds of people you hang out with.
So I went to the local coffee shop, a Starbucks in suburban Detroit, and talked to people about language.
Well, let me ask you some of these words and see if you recognize any of them.
Okay.
Monkey's wedding.
No.
A monkey gets married to another monkey.
Yeah, you are a monkey.
Discombobulated.
No.
What's that?
Cockroach killers.
No.
What do you think a mumble squibble is?
A who?
A mumble squibble.
Something that a kid made up.
That's Christy Zinn and Martez Johnson. A monkey's wedding is a chaotic, messy situation in Maine. Discombobulated is close to discombobulated. Cockroach killers are pointy shoes in New Jersey, and what many people call a noogie is a mumble squibble in North Carolina. While it's fun to learn about colloquial language, Joan Hall says there are serious practical uses for the DARE as well. Forensic linguists used it when a little girl was kidnapped and police had only a ransom note to go on.
And in this ransom note, the writer said, "Put $10,000 cash in a trash can on the Devil's Strip."
Devil's Strip is a term for that strip of grass between the sidewalk and the street. The phrase is used only in a tiny section of Ohio between Youngstown and Akron.
And as it happened, one of the suspects on the police list was a man from Akron. And being confronted with the linguistic as well as the other evidence, he ultimately confessed.
Doctors also use the dare to understand their patients who use colorful language to describe their complaints.
A patient might come in and say, "Doc, I've got the ground itch. I've got pip jennies."
That means a rash on the feet or pimples. The dare is meant to capture words and phrases like these before they disappear, the kind of language that sticks in your memory, as with Eileen Reichert's neighbor in Louisiana.
There was a very colorful neighbor we had, and I looked at him one day and I said, "Isn't it a beautiful day?" And he said, "If I was any happier, I'd have to be two people."
The Dictionary of American Regional English will finally reach Z next year when the last volume is released. The finished work contains 75,000 entries and will help you understand that if you're invited to a pitch-in or a scramble, you're really going to a potluck. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headlee in Detroit.
And if you want to try a random scoot into the world of unusual phrasings, visit our website, npr.org, and there's a list of quirky and unusual phrases.